The following is a rebroadcast of a show originally aired on WFMU and edited for rebroadcast on Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio in New York's Upper Hudson Valley, streaming online at wavefarm.org/listen.
And then you've got Doctor Strange, which is Now, what makes up that circuit? All these neurons, tons of neurons, billions and billions of synapses or connections between them. And that's where we're making sense of information. Now, if you were to look at this image, look at that. I'll show you some other images. And what we find is as you look at those images, you're bringing these into the clouds, making sense of all that information. And it used to be a black box. We didn't know really what was going on. Now we can use technology like functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what we're looking at here is a brain in action. So the same study was done on females. Something neutral, like a brick wall, and then a kick pocket, and something like dirt, and something like cotton. So what we're seeing is as those images are switching, you start to see where blood is flowing around in the brain, and you can start to figure out what the different parts of the brain actually do. We're able to figure out the function. So when we're looking at the cerebral, every picture that I've seen is from the sides of the eyes up here. But if we were to rotate 90 degrees, now we're looking at it head on, and find that there are two hemispheres, the right and the left hemisphere. Now they're connected in the middle, because it's a bit of midbrain,
a sitting just above the chair. So you can see this paired structure, paired spherical, this oval, lambda structures. These are called
Now if we were to go right below the it's made up of if you have somebody who has Parkinson's,
sometimes not problems.
You can access
We move farther up the curve, each element is
Hello. Hello. You're listening to Radio Ravioli. My name's Olivia. Man, what a day it has been. Here is to using this time to rewire the brain, rewire my brain. I woke up like 24 hours ago with cheeks swollen and lips swollen. I was having an allergic reaction. It was no fun. It was bad. My face was swollen until about 6 p.m. today, or 3 p.m., and it's been going down. Luckily, you can't see me over through the radio, but boy, was it a sight. It's a little bit normal now. I feel as though I'm coming back down to earth this evening, this morning, this time spent in the radio, in the studio here. And of course, I have a cold, so it's just the loveliest of mornings. It's November. Time for the body to betray me. Recharging, getting ready for my weekend. Starting over, maybe. Post-allergic reaction, post-strange body stretching. My face was in another dimension this morning. It was wild. You're listening to Radio Ravioli. Again, welcome and enjoy, and sit back, relax. I'm trying to. Man, oh man, what a day. Let's just forget it.
But he could only respond by repeating the word two, although he could still intonate as though he was speaking the word. Then, after some time in therapy, something rather unexpected happened. James regained some ability to communicate through singing. stroke of aphasia can sometimes be treated by teaching patients to sing, because singing uses a different region of the brain,
one that's on the right side, and that's analogous to Broca's area on the left.
So, after practice, James could sing words,
and he eventually realized how to talk by teaching the right side of his brain to speak rather than sing. Whether it's a stroke affecting your speech, a tumor destroying your memory, a concussion affecting your aggression, or that fateful iron rod that shot straight through Phineas Gage's skull, a lot of what we know about how the brain works has come from stomach injuries. And what we've learned so far is that even though it looks like a 1.4 kilogram lump of gray congealed oil, the brain is made up of super specific areas that have super specific functions. You might actually say the same thing about your brain that sometimes said about politics. Everything is local. Brain is bright, so I'll shave my eyes. I think this is a different region of the brain, one that's on the right side, and that's analogous to Broca's area on the left. So after some practice, James could sing words, and he eventually relearned how to talk by teaching the right side of his brain to speak rather than sing. Whether it's a stroke affecting your speech, a tumor destroying your memory, a concussion affecting your aggression, or that fateful iron rod that shot straight through Phineas Gage's skull, a lot of what we know about how the brain works has come from injuries. And what we've learned so far is that even though it looks like a 1.4 kilogram lump of gray congealed oatmeal, the brain is made up of super specific areas that have super specific functions. You might actually say the same thing about your brain that sometimes have a pulse. Everything is local. You'll remember that our nervous system is divided into two main networks that work in harmony. The central nervous system consisting of the amazing brain and spinal cord, and the peripheral nervous system made up of the nerves coming out of the central nervous system. The central nervous system's main game is integrating the sensory information that the peripheral system collects from all over the body and responding to it by coordinating both conscious and unconscious activity. The sun is bright, so I'll shave my eyes. I'm hungry, so I'm calling the pizza man. The phone is ringing. Maybe I'll answer. All these sensations, thoughts, and directions process through this two-party system. It's the brain, of course, that sorts out all that sensory information of the absorbers. It also carries out the most complex functions, like thinking, feeling, and remembering. Meanwhile, your spinal cord conducts two-way signals between your brain and the rest of your body, while also governing basic muscle reflexes and patterns that don't need your brain's blessing to work. This is how a chicken can still run around even before they were being captured. Both your spinal cord and brain are made of fragile, jelly-like nervous tissue, extremely susceptible to injury. So all that goo is well protected by the bones of your vertebrae and cranium, as well as membrane layers or meninges, before being bathed in a cushy water bed of clear cerebral spinal fluid. This fluid actually allows the brain to float by something in your skull, reducing its weight and letting it slosh around when you and your head are familiar. But even with all that extra protection, your brain is still vulnerable, and one thing that James has sort of taught us is that its vulnerabilities can be incredibly specific, because your brain is divided into specialized regions that may or may not interact with each other to produce a given action. You can better understand this division of labor by looking at how the brain first develops into its main component parts. Inside a developing embryo, the central nervous system starts off with a humble little neural tube. Soon, the caudal or lower end of the tube stretches out forming the spinal cord, while the cranial end begins to expand, divide, and enlarge into three primary brain vesicles, or interconnected chambers. This is kind of your prose. We call these chambers the prosencephalon, the mesencephalon, and the rhombencephalon, or forebrain, midbrain, and hindbrain. By an embryo's fifth week of development, these main three chambers start morphing into five secondary vesicles that essentially form the roots of what can be cut more grown-up brain structures. The prosencephalon divides into two sections, the telencephalon and the diencephalon. The rhombencephalon forms into another bear called the metencephalon and the myelencephalon. And in between, the mesencephalon, thanks to evolution, remains undivided. The real action starts as these five secondary vesicles start developing three major adult brain regions that you might be more familiar with. The brainstem, the cerebellum, the diencephalon, also known as the interbrain, and finally, the cerebral hemispheres. But in order to go from the simple tube into that classic wrinkly icon we think of as the brain, each of these five vesicles grows in different ways. Basically, some develop a lot more than others. The least dramatic changes occur in the three most caudal or lower sections, the mesencephalon, the metencephalon, and the myelencephalon. They go on to form the cerebellum, which mostly helps coordinate muscular activity, and the brainstem, which plays a vital role in relaying between the body and the higher regions of the brain. The brain stem actually has three main components, and I know this is getting to be a lot of vocabulary here. You have the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata. Together, they regulate many of the most basic vital and voluntary functions, like keeping your heart on pace, keeping your lungs working, and controlling things like sleep, appetite, pain, sensitivity, and awareness. But of the three brain stem parts, it's your midbrain that carries out the higher level functions. Like when your eyes track a fast moving object, or when you look behind you after hearing some sudden loud sound, it's the midbrain that receives and processes that sensory information and sends out the reflexive motor signals so you react without thinking. The midbrain also passes that data to regions like the cerebral cortex, which do the actual conscious thinking about the stimuli, like, what is that thing whizzing across the sky? What just exploded behind me? So with the brainstem, the cerebellum covering your basic light and motor functions, you start to see somewhat more complex tasks being carried out in the next major brain structure, the diencephalon. This is where you find the thalamus, hypothalamus, epithalamus, and the mammillary bodies, which regulate things like homeostasis, alertness, and reproductive activity. Here we also find part of the limbic system, which is a center for strong emotions and fear. This area is sometimes called the reptilian brain because we share it with some of our less philosophical animal brethren, like lizards and fish. I'm not putting these guys down, but by our standards, they don't think so much as focus on the more instinctual pursuits that are ruled by the caudal regions of the brain. Eat, drink, sleep, mate, stay safe. All those things are awesome, but it wasn't until the appearance of birds and mammals that some animals' brains came to be dominated by the last of the five vesicles, the telencephalon. During your brain's growth, the telencephalon undergoes the biggest changes of all as it develops into the most brainy part of your brain, the two classic walnut-looking hemispheres we collectively call the cerebrum that cover the rest of your brain like a mushroom cap on its stalk. That's the cerebrum, not to be confused with Cerebro, which is Professor X's telepathy-enhancing device, and it is the largest region of the brain and performs the highest functions. Yeah. It's made up of the wrinkly.
Life is bare. Gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather. Stormy weather. And I just can't.
Welcome to the University of Utah Neuroanatomy Laboratory. We're going to go hide and do some dissections of the brain and look at some of the important structures that.
The time. So weary all of the time. When he went away, the blues walked in and met me. Since my man and I, me and my daddy, ain't together. Keeps raining all of the time. Oh, oh, keeps raining all of the time. Oh, yeah, 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 raining all of time. Stormy, stormy, stormy weather.
those simulations fall into a cycle, as I said, and when they are anywhere between 14 to about 20 cycles per second, we call that beta brain activity, beta brain function. And this right here is what we say is more associated with the physical. This is what we say deals with the world of action. This is where you use your physical senses to get information that then you can utilize and apply towards problem solving, towards moving on effectively in this physical environment, towards making your choices and decisions, whatever it is. So we gather information for a lifetime.
In the muscle cells of your heart, where speed and team effort between cells is crucial.
This seems like a good system.
So why aren't all of our synapses electrical? It's largely a matter of control. With such a direct connection between cells, an action potential in one neuron will generate an action potential in the other cells across the synapse. That's great in places like your heart, because you definitely don't want half a heartbeat. But if every synapse in your body activated all of the neurons around it, your nervous system would basically always be in group text, with every muscle fiber in your organ tissue always being stimulated and then replying off the whole group, stimulated them even more until everyone just got maxed out and exhausted. Turn off their phones for good. That'll be bad, which is partly why we have chemical synapses. They are much more abundant and also smaller, and they're more precise and selective in what messages they send where. Rather than raw electricity, these synapses use neurotransmitters or signals that diffuse across the synaptic gap. The main advantage chemical synapses have over electrical ones is that they can effectively convert the signal in steps from electrical to chemical back to electrical, which allows for different ways to control that impulse. At the synapse, that signal can be modified, amplified, inhibited, or split, either immediately or over longer periods of time. This setup has two principal parts. The cell that's sending the signal is the presynaptic neuron, and it transmits through a knob-like structure called the presynaptic terminal, usually the axon. This terminal holds a whole bunch of tiny synaptic vesicle sacs, each loaded with thousands of molecules of given transmitter. The receiving cell, meanwhile, is, yes, thankfully, the postsynaptic neuron, and it accepts the neurotransmitters in its receptor region, which is usually on the dendrite or just on the cell body itself. And these two neurons communicate even though they never actually touch. Instead, there's a tiny gap called a synaptic cleft between them, less than 5 millionths of a centimeter apart. Something to remember is that messages that travel via chemical synapses are technically not transmitted directly between neurons like they are in electrical synapses. Instead, there's a whole chemical event that involves the release, diffusion, and perception of neurotransmitters and neurotransmit signals. And this all happens in a specific and important chain of events. When an action potential races along the axon, the neuron activated with sodium and potassium channels in a wave, it eventually comes down to the presynaptic terminal and activates the voltage-gated calcium channels there to open and release the calcium into the neuron's cytoplasm. This flow of positively charged calcium ions causes all those tiny synaptic vesicles to fuse with the cell membrane and purge their chemical messengers. And it's these neurotransmitters that act like couriers, diffusing across the synaptic gap, binding to receptor sites on the postsynaptic neuron. So the first neuron has managed to convert the electrical signal into a chemical one, but in order for it to become an active potential again in the receiving neuron, it has to be converted back to electrical. And that happens once a neurotransmitter binds to a receptor, and that's what causes the ion channels to open. And depending on which particular neurotransmitter binds to which receptor, the neuron might either get excited or inhibited. The neurotransmitter tells it what to do. Excitatory neurotransmitters depolarize the postsynaptic neuron by making the inside of it more positive and bringing it closer to its action potential threshold, making it more likely to fire that message on the next neuron. But an inhibitory neurotransmitter hyperpolarizes the postsynaptic neuron by making the inside more negative, driving its charge down, away from its threshold. So not only does the message not get passed along, it's now even harder to excite that portion of the neuron. Keep in mind here, any region of a single neuron may have hundreds of synapses, each with different inhibitory or excitatory neurotransmitters. So the likelihood of that postsynaptic neuron developing an action potential depends on the sum of all of the excitations and inhibitions in that area. Now we have over 100 different kinds of naturally occurring neurotransmitters in our bodies that serve different functions. They help us move around, keep our vital sleepy and moral character simply because they feel good. But neurotransmitters don't stay bonded to their receptors for more than milliseconds. After they deliver their message, they just sort of pop back out and either degrade or get recycled. Some kinds diffuse back across the synapse and are immediately reabsorbed by the sending neuron, a process called reuptake. Others are broken down by enzymes in the synaptic cleft and are sent away from the synapse by fusion. And this mechanism is what many drugs will shake and will so successfully exploit in order to create the desired effects. These drugs can either excite or inhibit the production of these and reuptake of neurotransmitters, and sometimes they can simply mimic neurotransmitters. Tricks to neurons to think it's getting a natural signal. Take cocaine, for example. Once it hits your bloodstream, it targets three major neurotransmitters: serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine.
Listening to Radio Ravioli. This is Wendy and Carl from their album Siddhar Bazaar from the year 2000. So, you know, I was getting dinner tonight. I scarfed down a soup and salad, tomato basil soup and a salad. And I almost ordered spinach ravioli, But I really wanted soup. But I think about if you have radio, not radio, if you have ravioli anecdotes, send them to me. Share them with me. You can go online. Whoa. Or you could email Olivia at WFMU.org. I want to hear from you. And all your ravioli whatevers, you know? Spinach ravioli did sound good. It was tempting. I almost got it. But I decided that I shouldn't. That I should get soup instead. I don't know if I made the right call, but the soup was good, you know? Soup was pretty tasty, I gotta say. I ate it in very shortly, very quickly. It was gone. But yeah, as I say, here on Radio Ravioli, we figure things out together. So I want to hear your thoughts, and especially your ravioli thoughts. That's what interests me most. I think about ravioli all the time. All the time, baby. Here's to forgetting the day before and charging ahead into the future, starting a new day, a new chapter, or whatever. One in which ravioli is plentiful. Many different types of raviolis.
Yeah. So they begin to get normalized. The second you normalize this anxiety, you avoid what happens. And to grip it, once you put it into practice, panic, distance, not just for struggle, but for effort. And that's a really important lesson. If you turn your head in, never let it be. And that's
Yeah, I'd love to hear you say that, because what I write in the book is get comfortable.
Just a second, comfortable. Which actually has no problem.